Access number 11938, reel 12.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 12. Did you, in fact, then, Mr. Iston, go to the office and mess?
No. No. I said I wasn't too happy. I suppose all my life I've been a bit of a loner. My brother didn't arrive till I was 10 and a half, so this is probably goes back to childhood that I was a loner. In France, I was more or less my own boss, except that Major Jeffries was my boss, but apart from that, I was more or less on my own. I knew what I had to do, and I did what Major Jeffries wanted me to do, and I was my own boss, to a certain extent. But there was pressure on me now to go to the officer's mess, and I had no intention of going to the officer's mess. I had two things going against me. By this time, of course, I was wearing a medal ribbon, a military medal ribbon. And I suppose that officers went round and say, who's that wearing the MMM? And somebody would say Iston, which is the second thing against me. It's an unusual name. It sticks out, Iston, I-C-E-T-O-N. There's not many Istons in the alphabet, not many I's in the alphabet. So that sticks in anybody's memory. And I suppose with the local officers, they'd think Iston. Oh, I know Iston. He used to be at Rugby Hall. He was the butler at Rugby Hall. And Rugby Hall was a very small country house, but my dad was the butler, and it was noted for its food and its service. And with Major Bill Watson coming back, he knew the house very well. In fact, he was a solicitor for the house. And I think he was trying to... He wanted his Barnet Castle lads to be special. And I suppose in a way they were special. It was a good company, B Company, when they left Barnet Castle. And he wanted to do his best for the company. And he expected them to be special. And I think a lot of pressure was coming from him, that Mr. Iston was the butler at Rugby, and he was a good butler, and it was a good food place, and he must know all about officers' mess catering and this sort of thing. And there was a lot of pressure put on me to go to the officers' mess. Fortunately for me, Peter Jeffries didn't think much about officers' mess either. He'd have been much happier having his foot out the billy can than putting his jack boots on to go down to a mess function. At least that was my opinion. He never gave me the opinion that was particularly happy about this. In fact, one instance, when he had to put the jack boots on, I had to dress him, because you put the trousers down over the jack boots, you put your feet in the jack boots, and you've got to be lifted on, because they're real tight-fitting things, and you've got to be there to dress them for the officer's mess, and to undress them when they came back. So one night we were busy with this thing, and he saw a light flickering. Well, a light, it wasn't flickering, it was a full window light away across the bay. I don't know whether it was Swire or Burton Bradstock or maybe even further across than that. Anyway, he saw this as a way out of the one mess dinner. We into the pickup, the Hillman pickup. We must have toured around for about 2 hours, I think, to get to this light. We finally got it. But by the time we got there, the wardens were there, and the light was extinguished. I don't know. It was suspected that that was a code for somebody. It was a direction light for something. Whatever happened, I'm not aware of the outcome of it. But certainly that was one mess dinner he missed. We found this light. So he wasn't interested in mess functions either, really. And he wasn't keen for me to go to the mess, I don't think. But I don't think he knew that he was going to leave as sharp as he did.
Can we just go back to the dressing part, which is you mentioned? Dressing then was quite a difficult task at times. An officer couldn't handle it on his own.
On these dinner occasions where they were wearing the full dress uniform, it was difficult. The trousers had to be... You set the boots out where the feet were going to go. The trousers were put inside and then folded down over the top of them. And then you've got to get the officer's feet into the boots, which are tight-fitting at the best of times. So you've got quite a struggle to get the feet in. and you've got to sort of lift the boot and the heel and work it over the heel because it is really tight. Worse than a Wellington. You know, I mean, a Wellington is a jack boot, but it's wide, whereas the jack boot is made to fit the feet, and they really do fit the feet, so they can walk in. I mean, the First World War, they used them out in the trenches, they wore the jack boots. But now, in the Second World War, they were used mainly for dress functions, part of the dress uniform. So there had to be a man there to help him. He couldn't get them on or off on his own. And the same with the jacket, you see, it was all right up to the neck. There was a shirt, and you had to have a little bit of white showing around the collar, and then the collar went very tight around the neck, almost choking. He couldn't have fastened his neck himself, I don't think. It had to be so tight. I don't really know why this is, but it was part of the dress uniform. He didn't like that. I don't think he did. And I didn't, certainly. And there was no way they were going to get me down in the mess if I could possibly help it. In the MT, certainly. I said before, I was hoping that he was still the colonel and he wanted a driver and a batman as well, and I could have done the driving. Unfortunately, it didn't work that way. But Bill Watson, he possibly saw me working through the mess fairly fast and becoming possibly the NCO in charge of the mess in a short space of time. We don't think of these things when they're happening to us. And the mess was the last thing I really wanted to do. It was... well, I'd seen it. I'd seen it in a country house where you have all the dressing up. My father used to change three times a day. He had a morning suit, an afternoon suit, and then a dinner suit. He had three changes every day. He had to change three times in the day. And the mess was on that sort of lines. You see, the stewards, the mess stewards, they used to change two and three times a day in the different uniforms. And I was off.
So
that.
Major Jeffries got you out of it?
I think so.
So what job did
but
you
certainly do? I was threatened a few times that if I didn't turn up, I was going to be all this, that and the other. So, but I never went. There was always something occurred that saved me from going. And I was more to go to the MT because I'd been trained as a fit. And that was what I wanted to do.
So you were with Major Jeffries, who was still with the battalion. What were your duties with him at this time?
Well, driving was the main thing. Driver, messenger, more or less as I'd done in France. I don't remember doing so much on Naffy when we were at Lytton Cheney. But certainly I used to do his messages and anything like that. For instance, one evening I took a message out to the big gun at West Bay on a motorbike. And I said there was two asphalt roads running west, east and west. Well, right on the beach there was a stone pebble road. It wasn't a rotary, it was a bridle path, more than anything. But we'd put mines out on the seaside, which were covered over when the tide came in, and it was mined all the way down there, and then there was dannet wire, the coiled wire, barbed wire, behind the mines. Then there was this bridle path, which was about 8 feet wide, maybe 10 feet wide. Then there was more dannet wire, and then there was a stretch of mines went up the bank till they came to the trenches where the boys were. And I had this message to take out one night. And I borrowed a motorbike and took it out on the motorbike, going along the pebble mill. I caught my sleeve on a bit of the dannet wire, because it was hard to ride a bike on this stuff. The back wheels just sinks, and you've got to be very careful how you operate. And it can skid like mad on a... It doesn't skid, it just sinks into the pebbles. And you sway all over the place. And I caught my sleeve on a bit of dannet wire and it pulled me off into the wire. And the bike was away on its own. That was on the, coming back towards West Bexington, before it hit the main road. So I was still doing his running, more or less, and his driving. And putting his things out for shaving and seeing he had his clothes and laundry, see the laundry was done. That was quite a point because the laundry got, wherever we went, was difficult to get the laundry done. Make sure there was always something handy for a meal because on one occasion we went off to Salisbury Plain for a day. We left before dawn and we got back after long after dark. We went to an artillery and tank demonstration on the plain at the School of Infantry. Terrific thing, all the brass was there. Never seen so much brass. And he paddled around with him and I was sort of toddling along behind him. We had a place to park. I was toddling along behind him. And it was a good day. It was now, you asked me a few tapes ago what we knew about artillery. Well, before going to France, we hadn't seen any artillery. We had no idea what the effect of artillery was. But this was a demonstration of artillery and you could see what it did. And they fired at dummy tanks, and then the tanks followed the artillery in the way it should be done. Except at Arras, we didn't have any artillery, did we? We had the tanks, but no artillery. I keep referring back to Arras because that was the only battle that we knew anything about at the time. And that was a really interesting day, but all the brass that was there, I've seen nothing like before. And it must have cost a fortune when you think about it. What artillery shares called, because there's quite a lot went over and there's a lot of tanks there. And it was a proper demonstration of how tanks and artillery should work and the infantry coming along behind them.
What guns, or what type of guns were being used?
25 pounders mainly. There was one or two 5.7s, which were the big medium guns, but mainly 25 pounders. And they were firing over our heads. And we were over the top. Which I was used to by then.
Major Jeffries, of course, left the battalion to go to the staff
yes.
college.
How that happened, I don't know. But Colonel Yates came from, I think again from the 8th Battalion. Oh, he had been the 2nd Battalion. And he must have been senior to Colonel Battiscombe, because he became the CO and Colonel Battiscombe became the 2nd Commandant. Major Jeffries vanished. I didn't quite know what had happened. Well, it was all arranged that way that Major Jeffries went to the staff college before this happened or not, I don't know. Or whether they just took advantage of the fact that they had two second commands. He went off to the staff college. And then I was in some predicament. And I just presented myself to the MT and made myself useful to the MT. And I'm more or less kept there.
What were you doing?
Well, I started helping the fitters wherever I could. But with them realising I had some knowledge of fitting, I was getting a lot of the long runs. For instance, on one occasion, two occasions, I went to Denham Studios, Rank Studios at Denham and at Shepperton for dummies. To go in the trenches to make them look as though the trenches were full when there was only about two men in each trench. I had another trip to Netley with the VD personnel. I didn't like those trips at all. I did explain one before, I think. I didn't like those trips, but I had another trip to Netley. I went to Exeter, Dorchester, which wasn't too far away, but I should be getting trips that weren't in the schedule. Anything was off the cuff sort of thing. I seem to be getting those sort of tricks with any sort of vehicle. And then we'd formed this cycle platoon to go out looking for tanks and reporting back on the bicycles. If they weren't to do anything, they'd just see if there's anything there and report back to their own individual commanders. From there, two of us went off with two or three tonners, and I don't know where we went. I haven't a clue. But we collected about 30 motorbikes, and we started a motorcycle platoon. All that I liked. That was great fun. One bike we brought back was a Triumph Twin, which was really an up-to-date bike in those days, a Triumph Twin. And my mate, Corporal Hanley, he liked a bike. Well, I liked a bike. You probably realised I'd taken a bike wherever I could get one and gone on a trip. So I liked a bike as well, and I fancied a BSA, which was a really good bike, a heavy 500, BSA 500. But Corporal Hanley fancied a trip on this Triumph Twin, and come and jump on the back and we'll go for a spin. So he twisted the throttle and let the clutch in, and I was left standing on the other way on the bike. It was so fast that the bike just left me. I just dropped off the back sort of thing when he took off. I think he got his shock because it was more or less on the speedway start, standing on his back wheel, away like mad. And poor Andy, he looked round and I wasn't there. But the motorbike patrol, that was great fun, except we were forever putting clutches in because the lads, a lot of the lads weren't bike riders, and they were driving on the clutch more than they were on the gears kind of thing. You know, they were using the clutch to take it away gently rather than take it away in bottom gear, let the clutch out and off. They were forever putting clutches in. In fact, we got to the state where we went to the pub. I don't know whether I mentioned it, but on the 8th, where we used to go fairly regular. We weren't too popular, actually, because they were trying to make it an officers' club. And we didn't like that, but we still went. And we went there and we had to get corks out of the bottles to try and put some clutches back in these bikes. We couldn't get the clutch. They were made up of segments in a steel plate. And we had to get these corks and try and level them off, put them in the segments and level them off and make a clutch plate of it. The only way we could keep them going. That didn't last very long, but it used to keep them going for a spell. So we had a platoon working.
What was the role of the motorcycle platoon?
Paratroopers, spotting paratroopers and going out and locating them and getting word back to where they were. Because this was a great fear now. I mean, after the Belgian episode and the Dutch episode, we were, if any attack, any invasion did come, it was going to be from the sea and from behind with paratroopers. So the recce platoon, the first start of the recce platoon. I mean, we had the recce platoon from the RNFs, but this was a battalion recce platoon. They were faster than the carrier, you see. The carrier was really the recce platoon for the battalion, but the motorbike was faster, and they could get on Devon and Dorset, in fact all the south coast, the roads are very narrow and nearly all sunken. So you've got to sort of go along the road to a spot and get off the bike and go up on the path and scout around, have a look around up the countryside, off the top of the road, off the bank of the road rather than off the road. And the carriers weren't too good for this. They were all right going across the fields, they weren't too good really on these sunken roads. And at this time, of course, we were trying to keep the farmers as busy as they could, trying to protect the farmers as much as we could until something really happened, and then, of course, it would have been across the fields. But at this time, we were trying to save the farms, because we needed all the stuff we could get from the farm. So the carriers weren't a great advantage in Dorset, not in this situation. If they'd gone across the fields, that would have been all right. But to protect the fields, the carriers weren't a great deal of good. So the motorcycle platoon was sort of taking over their kind of work. Naturally, if they wanted a Bren going forward, it would have to be a carrier that went forward with it. But that would have meant destroying the fields.
Come back to the fitters. What size was a fitters platoon?
There was a Sergeant Remy and a Corporal Remy. A Sergeant Fitter, doing light infantry. A Corporal and a Lance Corporal. There was a Technical Sergeant and a Technical Corporal. And about five like myself I think there were three fitters. And then about another two like myself who were handymen, as you might say. Probably I'd done more fitting than any of them, but I hadn't passed any army tests, so
And the duties were to keep the vehicles.
Yes. The maintenance, the immediate maintenance of the vehicles. Any major operations went back to LAD, which was brigade.
What's LAD?
LAD is a light air detachment. That was run by Remy. From there, it went to the field workshops in division. The division had a field workshop, again, run by Remy. You see, before that, it was all done by the regiments. But with Remy coming on the scene, they'd taken most of this work over. And, in fact, we were only supposed to have a corporal. The highest rank you could get in the Durham was supposed to be a corporal.
What do you recall about invasion scares at this time, Mr. Iston?
Well, there were a few invasion scares. Not that I got too involved myself, but the lads on the beaches, they were stood to on a number of occasions. In fact, they still did the stand to every morning and every night, which I explained before. And that was still done every morning and every night. And apart from that, there were scares which went on all night. And on a number of occasions, the lads were stood in the trenches all night. In fact, they were more or less permanently in the trenches. I explained we just brought dummies in to fill the trenches, and it'll tell you how short we were of men, even though we'd been reinforced. The distance we had to cover, and the distance the 8th Battalion had to cover, we're probably talking nearly 4 miles, I should think, which is quite a stretch for 2 battalions to cover. Oh, it's more than 4 miles. What are you talking about? It must be nearly 15 miles, I should think, along the coast, when you think that the coast wanders in and out quite a bit. So really, we were very, very scarce for men, and there was very little leisure time at all. I seem to recall that in the centre of the village of Litoncheney, I seem to think there was a vicarage, but I can't see a church, and I can't recall a church. Certainly there was some land down in the centre of the village on the left-hand side, going south, and in there I think was a cricket pitch, and certainly a sports field, because I remember doing something in there, but what, a bit vague, and it was probably a village fete or something like that was held there, and there was a certain amount of sports and some boxing, but not a lot of leisure time at all. The only leisure we got really was to go to this roadhouse at on the A35. On one occasion, I got a lift into Bridport and spent the afternoon there, and then I walked back along the beach. A beautiful summer day. And really, it's a wrong thing to say, but I just laid on the grass and watched the air battle going on above me.
Was there much air activity?
Oh, very, a lot. But this was a beautiful day, and I just laid there and watched, and a girl came and laid beside me, and I don't know who she was yet, but she just came. We've just laid on the watching the battles going on, and there were quite a few shot down. It was bad to tell to the naked eye what was. Every plane looks alike, more or less, went in the sky. The Spitfire certainly had a distinctive pointed wing, and the Hurricane was more of a longer wing, which wasn't quite so pointed. But they were bad to distinguish whether they were German or when they were coming down. You just saw a pall of smoke, and you looked to see if there was any parachutes coming.
Were you ever bombed?
Not really bombed, but at harvest time, which was supposed to be the end of August, September, maybe into September, they tried to destroy the fields with the incendiary bombs. And a lot of incendiary bombs were dropped right round us to try and set fire to the corn stacks. And that went on for about 3 weeks, I should think. It was purely to try and destroy the corn, so we were short of food, I should say. But I don't recall any bombs. Well, there might have been 2 or 3, but not really.
Did any German planes come down within your area?
I think there were three that we had to put guards on. I can't just recall where. I think one was against Swire. One was close to Bridport. And one somewhere in the Long Breedy area. I can't just recall exactly where. But we had to put guards on them too, until they were removed. Stop. Well, I know it's to stop people from pinching them, but it was just to protect them, keep what they could. There was one trip we did have, was a visit to the brewery at Bridport. It was an organised trip, it was quite interesting. It was the first time I'd really been through a brewery. That was pretty good.
How did the people receive you, and how did you get on with them?
I don't recall. I don't think that there was a lot of contact made with the people there. Not like Chipping Norton and Will Kingham. I don't recall so much, but I said at that stage, that place, I was a bit upset with myself because I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. And I was more of a loner there than I was anywhere else. So, in fact, I was walking back from Bridport on my own. I don't know. I think everybody had duties, and if you got a bit of spare time, you were on your own. You didn't sort of get the duties that a lot of you could go off together, apart from this one trip to the brewery. One occasion I do recall where six of us went off. The water truck, Charlie Hadley, he was a freelance, more or less. He had so much work to do, getting up and down to all the country. You know, he had to get water out to all the companies, to the cooks, and then to the various sections that were in the trenches and all that stuff. So he was more or less freelance. He knew what he wanted to get out. He knew to collect the water and to take it out. But one night, 6 hours, Tommy Russ, Charlie Hadley, Frankie Hanley, myself and two others, we borrowed the water truck and we went to a dance in Weymouth. Now, this is probably getting towards the 1st of September, because we'd been in the dance, it was 11:30. The announcement from the stage where the band was that all military personnel report to their units as quickly as possible. Well, of course, the panic then, because we'd only borrowed the water truck. It wasn't official, we just borrowed it. So we traipse ourselves out and gets on the water truck, and we're on our way back. And going up the hill, there's this pear-shaped red object in the sky. And I don't know, we're probably thinking the invasion's starting. We think there's a secret weapon up there, you see. We looked, what's this thing, for about half an hour on the way back. We never seemed to move, never changed. And we were almost back into Lytton Cheney when the clouds moved, and there was the moon. It was no secret object at all. But this just shows the sort of fear that does come over you when you're sort of waiting for things. And another time, we got back into Lytton Cheney, and then we had to sort of explain where the water truck had been, because they'd been looking for it to get some extra water out to the companies in case the invasion did start. There was definitely an invasion scare on, and they'd been looking for the water truck to get out some more water out. Anyway, Charlie got out of that one, and we all got back and donned our equipment and got back to where we should be. And there was nothing said about it. But this was a real scare, this thing over there, all the time. And another thing about how the nerves were getting, on three occasions, dogs were shot in the hedgerows because they hadn't answered the call, who goes there. And the dogs hadn't answered, so they were shot. You know, it just shows the state that nerves get into when you're waiting for something. And darkness is a great... what do you say, a fear maker, because you can hear ripples, you can see movement which isn't there. in dusk and darkness. So fear then to sort of get a grip of your people. And as I said, three dogs were shot and three blokes were charged for firing rifles unlawfully. How they got away, I don't know. But certainly they were charged because they'd fired their... you see, in a civilian, in a normal situation, every bullet has got to be accounted for. And every shell has got to be returned. If you're on the firing range, every shell has got to be returned. It's a cartridge case, I should say, rather than a shell. We talk of cartridge cases as shells. Not a shell from an artillery piece, but from a rifle. So every cartridge case has got to be accounted for, and every shot explained. So these lads were charged, and what happened in the end of the day, I don't know, but I think they got away with it in the finish. But it just explains how bad your nerves can get in these situations.
Was there any tragic accidents involving civilians?
I don't recall any. We had accidents. For instance, I was out trying a motorbike one day, and I finished up in the ditch and split my head open. David Joy had a great joy in stitching it back. I don't know if you ever...